had its American premiere just 3 days after the Swiss soccer boss announced his resignation. Only two people showed up at the Lamley Theater in Los Angeles's North Hollywood neighborhood for the first screening on the afternoon of June 5th. One, an older Mexican immigrant, said he was there because he liked the World Cup. The other, after watching the film, said it was very strange, and it seemed to him to be less than honest in its portrayal of history. The film, starring Tim Roth as Blatter, presented itself as a biopic with FIFA as the main character. But in truth, it was a story about how seemingly everyone within FIFA, for over a century, was irredeemably tainted, bigoted, corrupt, or incompetent, except for Blatter, who emerges from the film as a kind of hard-working, earnest saint, dedicated only to the sport and to the millions of impoverished children who play it around the globe. João Avalanche, his predecessor, is depicted as a cold-hearted vote-buying schemer, who shocks Blatter by telling him to keep a black book on his rivals to use against him. While the English, whose press corps tormented Blatter throughout his presidency, are portrayed as racist, sexist, self-important buffoons. Tellingly, the only character in the film other than Blatter who escapes such rough treatment is Horst Dassler, the intellectual father of the sports marketing industry that was now at the heart of FIFA's worst-ever crisis. By the time it was screened for a final time, on June 11th, the film's entire U.S. box office amounted to $918. United Passions, a film conceived to lionize Sepp Blatter, had earned the distinction of being the lowest-grossing commercial release in American history. Late on the morning of June 9th, Alejandro Berzaco, accompanied by a lawyer, walked out of the upscale Hotel Greif in the medieval mountainside town of Bolzano in northern Italy. Dressed in a blue Oxford shirt and jeans, he crossed the town's market square, passed its distinctive 800-year-old Romanesque cathedral, and finally reached the police station, where he surrendered. He had been keeping a low profile since arriving in Milan on May 27th, moving around Italy in the company of an Argentine lawyer who was a close friend, and had cut short a vacation to meet him. To avoid being tracked, the two men shared hotel rooms booked under the attorney's name, and soon moved to a nondescript condo near the beach on Italy's west coast. Burzacco retained a New York defense attorney, who flew to Italy twice to discuss his situation. Burzacco had dual Italian-Argentine citizenship, and thus could stay in Italy, try to lie low, and take his chances that if he were ever picked up, he might not be extradited. He could try to return to Argentina, but ran the risk of getting arrested at the airport. Or he could call up the prosecutors in Brooklyn and offer up his cooperation in hopes of leniency. Burzacco was from a prominent family in Argentina. His brother had been a congressman and chief of the Buenos Aires police, and was closely linked to the frontrunner to be the country's next president. Most of his assets had been frozen at the request of the U.S. government in coordination with the raids. And on the same day, his employees in Buenos Aires had destroyed countless sensitive company documents, as well as a secret computer server in Uruguay, where years' worth of bribes had been painstakingly accounted for. After some thought, Burzacco elected to waive extradition and try his luck with the Department of Justice. He chose to surrender in Bolzano because it was out of the way, and hoped it would draw little attention. But the publicity-starved local police decided to hold a press conference, and reporters soon swarmed the city's small jail. 2 days later, Burzacco received a call from his brother telling him that he was in danger. An order had apparently been given within the Buenos Aires provincial police ranks to prevent him from speaking to the U.S. prosecutors at any cost, even if it meant killing him. Burzacco was still in Italy, now under house arrest at a bed and breakfast outside Bolzano, as he anxiously waited for the extradition formalities to conclude. His family and some friends came to visit him during that time, and he became convinced he was making the right decision. Finally, on July 29th, Burzacco flew from Italy to Kennedy Airport in New York, where Jared Randall met him at the gate and put him under arrest. He would start meeting with prosecutors the next day, but it so happened that his favorite team, River Plate, was playing in the first leg of the Copa Libertadores final that evening. Randall, who had to watch over him until he made bond, tracked down a portable radio so he could listen to the match. Buruzako was arraigned 2 days later, with his sister, mother, brother, ex-wife, and several friends watching from the gallery. According to a 2009 study of criminal courts around the country, the average bail for all types of felonies was $55,400, with murder, the most serious crime, tipping the scale at just over $1 million. The 51-year-old chief executive of Torneos y Competencias was not accused of any violent crimes, much less murder. The charges he faced were wire fraud, money laundering, and racketeering. But he was no typical defendant, and this was no typical case. Buruzako's bond would be $20 million, secured by $3.3 million in cash, three pieces of real estate, and his stake in Torneos, which the prosecutors estimated was worth at least $15 million. He'd be placed under house arrest in New York, unable to go outside without permission from the FBI, and would have to pay for round-the-clock private security as well as GPS monitoring. The investigation had reeled in another cooperator, as important in some ways as Avila or Blazer. Buruzako told prosecutors he had paid more than $150 million in bribes to dozens of soccer officials over the course of many years. He was highly intelligent, knowledgeable, loved soccer, and spoke flawless English. Almost 4 months later, Buruzako won his cooperation agreement, too, consenting to plead guilty to three felony counts and to forfeit the tidy sum of $21,694,408.49. On July 26th, Mexico handily defeated Jamaica 3-1 before 69,000 fans at Lincoln Financial Field in Philadelphia to win its 10th Gold Cup title. Immediately afterward, CONCACAF's new Honduran president, Alfredo Howitt, stood at midfield and handed the oversized trophy to Mexican midfielder Andres Guardado, who had scored the match's first goal with a spectacular volley. That same day, Howitt met privately with Fabio Tordon, a consultant based in Miami, to discuss sports marketing firm Full Play's failed attempt, more than 3 years earlier, to win the rights to the Gold Cup and other CONCACAF tournaments. Tordon had played middleman in the scheme, first putting Hugo and Mariana Hincas in touch with Howitt and the two other Central Americans, and then helping coordinate the bribe payments. Now that the American criminal investigation was public and the Hincases had been indicted, Tordon told Howitt, he worried that the bribes would come to light. Howitt alone had received $250,000, and Tordon was terrified. The Confederation president responded calmly. There was no cause for concern, he said, as he'd come up with a clever way to cover his tracks using a fake contract. Nobody would ever know. Unfortunately for Howitt, Tordon was wearing a wire. Shortly after the indictment was unsealed, the prosecutors in Brooklyn had sent him what's known as a target letter, advising him he was under investigation. So Tordon hired an attorney, and in short order he was cooperating too. Howitt's tenure as CONCACAF president would prove exceedingly short. Chapter 29, A Zealous Advocate. David Torres Segrist was driving home in his minivan after singing in choir at midweek mass in Arcadia, California, when his assistant soccer coach called him on his cell phone. "It's my uncle," the man said. "He's been arrested and needs help. His name is Eugenio Figueiredo." Torres Segrist had five children. In addition to his church commitments, he volunteered as the youth soccer team's head coach, as an assistant scoutmaster for the Boy Scouts, and was involved in the PTA at his kid's school. He was also an attorney who had handled a wide variety of civil litigation over the past dozen years, largely involving suing or defending small municipalities in contract disputes. The name Figueiredo didn't ring a bell, but Torres Segrist figured the problem was something minor, maybe a DUI, and said he'd be glad to help. "Great," his friend replied. How soon can you leave for Zurich? Torres Sigrist, who had curly brown hair, a short-cropped beard, and an informal manner, was born and raised in Southern California. He favored shorts and flip-flops, and had never before felt the need to own a passport. The next morning, he drove to a government passport agency in West Los Angeles and waited in line for hours to get one on an expedited basis. He left for Zurich the next day, May 29th, taking advantage of the 11-hour flight to catch up on the torrent of FIFA news that had erupted since word of the arrests had broken 2 days earlier. He didn't follow international soccer at all, and until then had no clue that his friend's Uruguayan uncle was one of the sport's global elite, much less that he had been one of the officials arrested at the Bor Olak. Once in Switzerland, he went directly from the airport to meet Figueiredo's wife, Carmen Burgos, who was staying with a friend. Figueiredo's bank accounts had been frozen, and Burgos, already overwrought, discovered she couldn't withdraw a single Swiss franc from a cash machine. The indictment was from the U.S., so she knew her husband needed an American lawyer. But the few she'd already talked to mentioned gigantic fees, and Burgos found the whole process intimidating. Torres Sigrist was American, and he spoke Spanish. Perhaps, Burgos suggested, he could help negotiate a better price. But after spending a few days in Zurich meeting with lawyers from several big law firms, the California attorney felt disgusted. Rather than discuss the facts of the case, they wanted only to talk fees. One firm's blended hourly rate was $1,400. Another's was $1,800. A third refused even to come to Zurich unless Burgos put several hundred thousand dollars in escrow. Torres Sigrist suggested a more affordable alternative. Hire him instead. It was true he'd never handled a criminal case, much less one as massive as this, but something deep inside him told him he could handle it. What did they have to lose?
The Swiss lawyer Figueiredo had already retained was urging them to waive extradition and cut a deal as fast as possible. An Uruguayan lawyer who had flown in from Montevideo offered the same advice.
The United States, they said, was just too powerful. Figueiredo would lose the initial extradition proceeding, they said, and even with appeals all the way up to Switzerland's Supreme Court, he would end up dragged to Brooklyn in no more than 6 or 7 months. Torres Sigrist thought he could do better than that. When he wasn't with Burgos, interviewing lawyers or visiting Figueiredo in his immaculate little Swiss jail cell, he was thinking relentlessly about the criminal case and the issues it touched. This was not a typical RICO case. This was something much bigger. It was about sports, sure, but also global politics, and huge and complicated issues involving national identity, not to mention countless billions of dollars spent on television, sponsorship, and infrastructure revolving around each World Cup. FIFA was powerful, and despite the wild jubilation of fans around the world in the wake of the arrests, it was hard to believe everyone on Earth was so delighted at the state of affairs. Surely, Torres Sigrist thought, there must be somebody out there who was unhappy with the investigation and had some useful advice to share. After a week in Zurich, he had to get home to his family. The day before departing, however, he took the train to the Swiss capital, Bern, and hailed a taxi. It was a gloomy day, and a heavy rain fell as Torres Sigrist rang the bell at the gate outside the Russian embassy. The inspiration, he would later claim, had come to him in a flash. Russia was hosting the next World Cup in 2018. If there was anybody who would be critical of a massive U.S. investigation calling into question the integrity of FIFA and the sport of soccer as a whole, and who also had the resources to do something about it, surely it was Russia. After some time, a guard appeared. It was Saturday, so nobody from the embassy's legal department was there, he explained. Torres Sigrist, dripping wet, handed the Russian guard his business card and climbed back into the waiting taxi. A lawyer, Torres Sigrist often repeated to himself, quoting the American Bar Association's rules of professional conduct from memory, can be a zealous advocate on behalf of a client.
Figueiredo, short and slender with hangdog eyes, had started his life in soccer as a right winger for Huracán Buceo, a club in Montevideo, and slowly ground his way up the sports hierarchy, eventually becoming president of CONMEBOL in 2013.
Outside of soccer, the only job Figueiredo ever had for any length of time was as a used car salesman. He had worked briefly as a young man at a Volkswagen dealership, but quit to open his own tiny used car lot. He closed the dealership when he was 60, claiming it was his only source of income. But he'd grown very wealthy along the way thanks to the decades of bribes he'd been taking from sports marketing firms in his capacity as a soccer official, first in Uruguay, and particularly at CONMEBOL. He'd poured most of the money into real estate, largely in Uruguay, but also in a well-to-do enclave east of Los Angeles called Arcadia, where his wife's favorite nephew lived. Among the properties was an ornate six-bedroom house with a pool just 2 miles from the Santa Anita racetrack,
which Figueiredo had purchased for $475,000 and was now worth at least 3 times that.
He was careful and used an archipelago of shell companies, as well as numerous variations of the names of his wife and children, to hide the true ownership of all that property. He had also, in 2005, applied for U.S. citizenship, falsely claiming he suffered from severe dementia to get out of the English proficiency requirement. Steve Berryman had tracked down that little detail, as well as a series of fraudulent tax returns,
allowing the prosecutors to slap Figueiredo
with a host of slam-dunk additional charges that could add 25 years to his maximum sentence and make it that much more likely he'd volunteer to cooperate.
Figueiredo
had been entrenched in CONMEBOL for 2 decades, and was closely tied to some of the most powerful men in the sport. There was no telling what leads he'd hand over once the Swiss authorities rubber-stamped his extradition and he began cooperating like all the others. Sitting across a conference room table from Evan Norris in Brooklyn, Torres Sigrist found himself plunging into a truly foul mood. It was toward the second half of July, and his client,
Figueiredo,
was still in a jail cell in Switzerland. The Swiss and Uruguayan attorneys,
also on the case, were still urging Figueiredo to cut a deal,
arguing that the faster he got in the door, the better the prosecutors would treat him. That seemed to have been Jeffrey Webb's strategy. Advised by his American attorney, a partner at a big multinational firm who had been a federal prosecutor in New York for almost a decade, Webb waived extradition as soon as the formal petitions were submitted by the U.S. on July 1st. The former CONCACAF president arrived at Kennedy Airport on July 15th, and he was arraigned and released 3 days later on $10 million bond. To secure his liberty, Webb had to put up the deeds to 10 properties owned by himself, his wife, and numerous family members. His wife's retirement account, her stake in a medical practice, 12 high-end watches, much of his wife's jewelry, and 3 automobiles, including his brand-new Ferrari. Webb even had to hand over his wife's wedding ring. That was Berryman's suggestion. He'd traced a suspect $36,000 payment to a jewelry wholesaler. And then, after spending time looking at photos posted online of the couple's gala 2013 wedding, realized where that money had gone. Torres Sigrist was eager to talk with the prosecutors about what cooperation would look like. But Norris was only interested in discussing bond. He wanted $15 million, he said, with a large chunk of that in cash, and it was non-negotiable.
Cooperation was something they could talk about once Figueiredo was in Brooklyn.
Torres Sigrist had heard about how the prosecutors had put the screws to Webb, who had bent over backward to accommodate them. He had been speaking with attorneys for some of the other defendants, sharing bits of information about the case, and they, too, had been complaining about giant bond requirements. Even Aaron Davidson, small fry compared to some of the officials in the case, had to post $5 million. The California lawyer looked around the conference room. It was a bit shabby with years of use, utilitarian, and certainly not impressive. So this, he thought to himself, was what the belly of the beast looks like. The two lawyers were about the same age, but in some ways they couldn't be more different. Norris had gone to Harvard Law, and everything about him rubbed Torres Segrist the wrong way, particularly his cold, superior demeanor. Torres Segrist had gone to Southwestern in Los Angeles, known for its part-time law programs for people holding down jobs while studying, and he'd spent years paying dues on penny-ante cases in small courtrooms around Los Angeles County. Norris, he thought, was acting like an elitist prick. En route to Brooklyn, Torres Segrist had made a brief stop in Washington, where he'd gone to the Russian embassy to meet with a lawyer who had gotten in contact with him soon after he dropped his card off in Switzerland. The Russian attorney said research was being done on the case. He also suggested returning to the embassy in Switzerland again the next time he was over there. Figueiredo, 83 years old, had been crystal clear. He did not want to be extradited. Accepting every one of the prosecutor's intractable demands didn't feel like zealous advocacy for his client. It felt like surrender. For Torres Segrist, that wasn't an option. On July 24th, Torres Segrist sat down with a political liaison at the Russian embassy in Bern, who provided him with a stack of cases in which the U.S. had lost extradition fights in Switzerland. One from 2005 involved a Russian nuclear scientist whom the Swiss had arrested at the behest of American prosecutors, accusing him of stealing $9 million in Department of Energy funds. Before he could be extradited, however, Russia filed its own extradition request, also alleging financial crimes. Russia won out, and the U.S. was never able to lay a finger on the man. The key to keeping someone out of the U.S. was, for some other country, preferably one where he was a citizen, to file a competing extradition petition. Torres Segrist, the liaison hinted suggestively, should try to figure out if Uruguay could make its own criminal case against Figueiredo. The liaison also emphatically suggested he go to St. Petersburg, where FIFA would be holding the preliminary draw for the 2018 World Cup at the Constantine Palace the following day. As the first official event leading up to the tournament, all of FIFA's top officials would be in attendance, and there was someone important who wanted to meet him there. In less than 3 hours, the liaison arranged for a 7-day visa, and Torres Segrist booked a flight while he waited. He spent the afternoon of July 25th mingling with soccer officials at the Constantine Palace, where he was given red carpet treatment and admitted to the VIP area. Finally, a call came in telling the lawyer to be at Levashovo Airport the next morning, and that someone would come by his hotel that night to collect all his electronics, cell phone and laptop, prior to the meeting. Levashovo turned out to be a military airbase, completely different from the commercial airport Torres Segrist had arrived at. It was sometimes used for private aviation, and as he waited, a steady stream of FIFA officials in chauffeured Bentleys arrived to catch planes home, among them Sepp Blatter. Finally, Torres Segrist was summoned to a meeting room, where he was warmly greeted by Vitali Mutko. Mutko, with a round expressive face and dark slicked back hair, was president of the Russian Football Union, a member of FIFA's executive committee, and chairman of the local organizing committee for the 2018 World Cup. Since 2009, he had also been Russia's Minister of Sport, and was a close advisor to Vladimir Putin, whom he had first met in the early 1990s when both worked in the St. Petersburg city government. Speaking in thickly accented English, Mutko told Torres Segrist that he was familiar with the Figueiredo case and was eager to help. "As you can see," the minister said, "we've spent billions of dollars on infrastructure for the World Cup. It would be highly undesirable," he added, "for the U.S. to blemish FIFA, and by extension, Russia's World Cup." The meeting lasted 20 minutes, during which time Mutko talked generally about the case, but also mentioned specific strategies that could be used to beat the American extradition request. Some things, he said, Torres Segrist would be informed about and take an active role in. Others would, by necessity, be done without his knowledge. "All available resources will be given to this," Mutko assured him before saying goodbye. Torres Sigrist headed back to his hotel, collected his cell phone and laptop, and flew back to Switzerland, his head spinning. He wasn't entirely sure how his mundane life as an attorney litigating municipal contract disputes had taken such a dramatic turn. But at least he had a pretty clear picture of where his client's case was now heading. On September 14th, Loretta Lynch held a joint press conference in Zurich with Michael Lauber, Switzerland's Attorney General. Ostensibly, she had traveled there to attend an annual meeting of federal prosecutors, but normally America's highest-ranking law enforcement officials skipped such events. In truth, her presence was part of an effort to smooth things over with Swiss authorities, still upset about the leaks during the May 27th raids. The fact that the prosecutors' conference happened to be in Switzerland that year provided the perfect excuse for Lynch to get on stage with Lauber, shake his hand for the cameras, and praise the work of her counterparts. "I want to thank the Swiss government for its assistance in the extradition process," Lynch said. "We could not ask for a better partner than Attorney General Lauber." 3 days later, Switzerland's Federal Office of Justice ruled in favor of the petition to bring Figueiredo to the United States, making him the first soccer official arrested in the case to face forced extradition. By law, Figueiredo had a month to appeal. On October 13th, just days before the deadline, Uruguay's Court for Organized Crime formally submitted to Switzerland a petition for the extradition of Eugenio Figueiredo, accusing him of fraud and money laundering. Prosecutors in Montevideo had resurrected a nearly 2-year-old criminal referral that had been filed against Figueiredo, accusing him of corruption. The referral, filed by private citizens, alleged he and other CONMEBOL officials had conspired to reject competitive offers for rights to soccer tournaments because they were taking bribes. It offered no concrete proof, just the suggestion that authorities follow the money to determine who was unduly benefiting. The Uruguayan prosecutors had largely ignored it when it was filed, questioning, among other things, if it should have instead been filed in Paraguay, since that's where CONMEBOL is headquartered, and it fell into a kind of legal limbo, moribund.
Then suddenly, and with uncanny timing,
the unsubstantiated referral was converted into an active investigation. In its extradition petition, the court said that Figueiredo had indicated he was disposed to cooperate with the Uruguayan judicial system, which would seek a prison term of between 2 and 15 years against him. Few gave Uruguay's petition much chance of success. It was, after all, a tiny country, comparable in both size and population to the state of Oklahoma. While it was, relative to other South American countries, a fairly stable democracy, its reputation for law and order was nowhere near that of the United States. The biggest difference, however, was the tenor of the accusations.
The charges leveled by the U.S. against Figueiredo were backed by a thorough, detailed investigation that unequivocally laid out the prosecution's argument for criminality, based on multiple witnesses and reams of documents.
Uruguay's case seemed paper-thin by comparison. It was based largely on the unproven accusations of the 2-year-old referral, and the only evidence it supplied were records of a dozen years' worth of real estate transactions handed over by Figueiredo himself that Uruguay argued bear no relation to his economic capacity, nor the legitimate income derived from work as a sports official. Furthermore, the petition made no substantive argument about the nature of the frauds that allegedly generated all of Figueiredo's money, other than to say vaguely that so much money could only be the fruit of conspiracies and artificial schemes designed to injure various soccer institutions. Despite the striking contrast between the two petitions, the Swiss Federal Office of Justice on November 9th shockingly ruled in favor of Uruguay. In a terse ruling,
it said that because Figueiredo was willing to waive extradition to Uruguay but not the U.S., it would send him home,
provided the U.S. didn't object. but the U.S. did object. Justice Department attorneys argued that since the U.S. had first requested the arrest of the South American soccer official back in May, well before Uruguay had charged or sought the extradition of Mr. Figueiredo, it ought to have first priority. With the U.S. appeal pending, Torres Segrist made plans to fly to New York in early December and meet with Norris a second time to discuss bond for Figueiredo. Everyone expected Uruguay to lose. It was time, the prosecutors had said, for him to get serious. Yet something in the lawyer's gut told him not to go just yet, and he postponed the meeting.
On December 18th, the Swiss court once again came down in Uruguay's favor, stating that the criminal charges described in its petition covered all the facts contained in the U.S. extradition request, and pointing to Figueiredo's age and health as deciding factors. The better prospect of social rehabilitation seems to be in Uruguay, the ruling said, noting that the decision did not preclude the U.S. from petitioning Uruguay for Figueiredo's extradition to the U.S. for the immigration fraud charge at a later date.
Torres Segrist was sound asleep when the call came in with the good news. It was 3 a.m. in Arcadia, but he didn't mind. It had been the most exciting, difficult case of his life, and he danced around his bedroom, whooping and overcome with joy.
Later that day, after he had triple confirmed that Figueiredo was indeed going to Uruguay,
and the decision was truly final, Torres Segrist drove to the Arcadia post office and mailed a gaily decorated holiday card to Norris. "Merry Christmas," it said. Chapter 30. Plus ça change. In pre-dawn darkness, plainclothes Swiss police once again walked into the lobby of the Bor au Lac at precisely 6 o'clock on the morning of Thursday, December 3rd, 2015. As they had 6 months earlier, the officers arrived with no fanfare and as inconspicuously as possible. This time, however, they were determined to keep the secret operation under wraps and instructed hotel staff to clear the lobby.
Then they went upstairs to the guest rooms of CONCACAF President Alfredo Howitt and Juan Angel Naput,
the Paraguayan president of CONMEBOL. Both men were FIFA vice presidents and were in town to attend 2 days of meetings of the EXCO, which had commenced the previous afternoon. The two Latin Americans had attended a dinner for top soccer officials at the exclusive Sonnenberg restaurant the night before, and on this day were expected back in the underground boardroom of FIFA House at 9 a.m. for the second meeting, where the committee would vote on a series of reforms aimed at improving FIFA's integrity. Howitt, who had traveled to Zurich with his wife, opened the door almost immediately after the police knocked, and one of the officers read him the arrest warrant, which was translated into German, English, and Spanish. He told the official he had the right to contact the Honduran consulate. He and Naput were each given time to dress and pack a bag, then were led out of the hotel into the frosty winter air and hustled across a bridge to a parking garage, where several unmarked vehicles awaited. In little more than half an hour, they were gone, and Bor au Lac staffers hurriedly finished preparations for the breakfast service. The arrests, which so closely mirrored those of the past May, marked the culmination of the second phase of the soccer investigation. 8 days earlier, a federal grand jury in Brooklyn handed down a superseding indictment, which somehow managed to make the first version of the document look puny. Weighing in at 236 pages, the new charging document was among the longest and most detailed in the history of America's federal courts. The indictment was written by Norris with input from 8 other assistant U.S. attorneys now on the case. Its table of contents alone ran a page and a half, and it leveled 92 criminal counts against 27 defendants. 16 of those defendants were new, although many were in fact officials that Norris and the other prosecutors had been targeting for years, but hadn't quite been able to charge the first time around, such as Ricardo Teixeira and Marco Polo del Nero of Brazil. Those men were joined by a host of other soccer officials tied up in various corrupt schemes. The prosecutors had been able to expand the case substantially, thanks in large part to the flood of cooperators who had rushed to Brooklyn in hopes of leniency over the past few months. Indeed, no fewer than 7 people had pleaded guilty that November, among them Alejandro Brusaco, Jeffrey Webb,
and José Margulies, a Brazilian-Argentine bagman who had helped Avila, among others, pay countless bribes over multiple decades. All were secretly helping the investigation, and collectively, they had agreed to forfeit more than $41 million in exchange for their cooperation agreements. All the additional help allowed the prosecution to significantly deepen and solidify the allegations first unveiled in May, fortifying the existing case against men like Leos, Warner, and both Hinkises, who were still fighting extradition in their home countries. Yet a close reading of the new charges showed that the bulk of the new ground broken in the previous 6 months came in Central America. 7 of the new names atop the indictment were from the region, among them Howitt. Just as Jeffrey Webb had come into the CONCACAF presidency in the wake of a scandal that toppled the prior leadership and immediately cast himself as a reformer, so too had Howitt assumed power amid chaos and promised positive change. CONCACAF has been the victim of fraud, Howitt said just one day after the May 27 arrests. We are at an important moment for the game, a moment that we must not squander. CONCACAF stands ready to assist in the process of rebuilding FIFA in a way that strengthens the game for many years to come. Among the first acts he oversaw as president was the decision to formally dismiss Webb, and a few days later, CONCACAF also suspended Enrique Sanz, motivated by the revelation that he had been secretly cooperating with the Department of Justice. In August, Howitt fired the cancer-stricken general secretary, paying him an undisclosed sum as a termination settlement. Just as Webb began his term announcing an internal investigation of the Confederation's prior leadership, conducted by Sidley Austin, so too did Howitt launch an internal probe, conducted by Sidley Austin. And just as Webb had been the very first name atop the original indictment, and had long before sunrise been yanked from the luxurious embrace of the Boer Olak, and cast into ignominy and public shame, so too was Howitt just 6 months later. 3 successive presidents of CONCACAF, Warner, Webb, and Howitt, and 3 successive presidents of CONMEBOL, Leos, Figueiredo, Naput, corrupted, indicted, and disgraced. As the saying goes, it was deja vu all over again. The corruption of the enterprise became endemic, Norris wrote in the indictment. Certain defendants and their co-conspirators rose to power, unlawfully amassed significant personal fortunes by defrauding the organizations they were chosen to serve, and were exposed and then either expelled from those organizations or forced to resign. Other defendants and their co-conspirators came to power in the wake of scandal, promising reform. Rather than repair the harm done to the sport and its institutions, however, these defendants and their co-conspirators quickly engaged in the same unlawful practices that had enriched their predecessors. There was one additional way that the second round of arrests in the Boer Olak proved hauntingly similar to those that had taken place in May. 15 minutes before the Swiss police walked into the luxury hotel in the heart of Zurich on the morning of December 3rd, a reporter from the New York Times pushed through the revolving doors and took a seat with a good view of the lobby. As the cops arrived in their cars, a photographer waiting outside texted the reporter, who relayed the information to editors in Manhattan. The reporter sent out a tweet from his phone breaking the news of the arrests at 6:01 a.m., and 20 minutes later the newspaper posted an article on its website. More than 12 hours before Loretta Lynch was scheduled to announce the indictments in a press conference in Washington. Once again, the prosecution had been scooped by the Times. As he did every day, Sepp Blatter woke up early on February 26, 2016, and started to dance. It was how the 79-year-old stretched his compact frame and his principal form of exercise. With the radio tuned to a local pop music station,
Blatter shimmied and bopped around his large, spare apartment, located in the city's wealthiest district, high on a hill overlooking Lake Zurich's eastern shore. It was by no means a typical morning, however, for within hours, Blatter and the world would be witnessing the election of FIFA's first new president in nearly 18 years. The election was the centerpiece of a FIFA Congress starting that morning at the Hallenstadion, the cavernous arena on the other side of town that was home to Zurich's formidable hockey team, the ZSC Lions. Although thousands of people, including delegates, press, and observers, would jam into the stadium for the election, Blatter would not be among them. He had been banned by FIFA's ethics committee from all soccer activities, which meant he would be forced to watch the election from home, streaming on his tablet. The Swiss administrator had never imagined his life in soccer would end this way. FIFA had occupied the center of his entire life over the previous four decades. He ate most of his meals and received most visitors at the Sonnenberg, the restaurant directly adjacent to the old FIFA house. His home was located directly between the two headquarters buildings. Even the drink coasters in his kitchen bore the FIFA logo. His decision to resign in the wake of the humiliating arrests the previous May had not been an easy one, but at least it would provide him with a way to gracefully transition out of the powerful office while playing a role in blessing a chosen successor, as João Havelange had done for him when Blatter first was elected in 1998. After all, Blatter had not been named in the U.S. indictment, and given that investigations focus on North and South America, it seemed unlikely he would be. His plan was to have been in the Hallenstadion on this special day, so he could personally and very graciously hand the crown to FIFA's next leader, who hopefully would reward him with the same honorary lifetime presidency that he had given Havelange in 1998. It was to be the capstone of Blatter's legacy, which now mattered to him more than anything else. But it hadn't worked out as planned. During EXCO meetings in late September, the Swiss Attorney General raided FIFA headquarters, searching Blatter's office and seizing numerous boxes of documents, as well as his computer. The Swiss federal prosecutor then announced that it had opened a criminal investigation of Blatter. The probe revolved around a 2 million franc payment Blatter had made to another soccer official in early 2011, while he was campaigning for re-election against Mohammed bin Hammam. Coming so soon before the vote, it looked worryingly as if Blatter had been trying to buy political support with FIFA's money. Prosecutors then wanted to know whether the money was in fact a disloyal payment made at the expense of FIFA, which under Swiss law would be a crime. 2 weeks later, FIFA's ethics committee provisionally banned Blatter for 90 days pending its own probe of the payment. The stress of the situation was beginning to take a serious toll on Blatter. He appealed the ban, but as he awaited a ruling, Blatter suffered a nervous collapse in early November and was admitted to the hospital. "I was really between the angels who sing and the devil who lights the fire," Blatter said after being discharged from the hospital. FIFA eventually rejected his appeal, and subsequently banned Blatter from the sport for 8 years, a penalty that was reduced to 6 years. For Blatter, who would be 85 by the time the punishment expired, FIFA's ban was as good as a lifetime expulsion. Over the previous 9 months, Blatter had been publicly humiliated, shamed, mocked, and scolded, targeted by prosecutors in two countries, and cast out of the organization that had defined most of his adult life. And yet, as the February Congress began with a video promising a new way forward, the sprightly former public relations man seemed in surprisingly good spirits. Dressed in jeans and a tailored gray sport coat over a dark blue shirt, with his initials monogrammed on the cuff, Blatter sat on a stool at his kitchen counter and watched the event on his iPad, pulling faces at the long-winded speeches and dropping sarcastic comments about the five candidates for the presidency. "Why do you wear this silly green tie, Jérôme?" he asked, pointing at the screen as the former French diplomat, Jérôme Champagne, an old friend of Blatter's, began his speech. Champagne, like Jordan's Prince Ali and the South African candidate, Tokyo Sekwali, was a long shot. The front-runners were Sheikh Salman bin Ibrahim al-Khalifa of Bahrain, the successor to Mohammed bin Hammam as president of the Asian Football Confederation, and Gianni Infantino, another Swiss who was general secretary of the European Soccer Confederation, UEFA. FIFA's elections are extremely long events, and this one was no different, clocking in at more than 5.5 hours. As Blatter watched, Corinne, his only child, periodically came into the kitchen to check on him. In another room, two of his advisors chatted quietly about his public relations strategy. The apartment was typically Swiss, immaculately unadorned in a way that betrayed an extreme degree of attention to every detail. There were almost none of the trophies one might expect from a man who, for 41 years, had stood at the summit of world soccer. In the living room, beside a blue vase of dried flowers, was a certificate from Real Madrid naming Blatter an honorary member. On a shelf above it stood a framed memento from Pope Benedict XVI, and beside that an empty silver picture frame. That was all. On the day of the mayorest at the Bor Olac, Blatter had called Switzerland's Minister of Defense, whom he knew personally. That man informed him that the Justice Ministry had warned nobody in government what was coming. It had been an absolute and total secret. That, Blatter said, convinced him that the entire criminal investigation was an elaborate form of revenge by the U.S., which he believed was bitter it had not been selected to host the 2022 World Cup. The soccer corruption investigation, in other words, was just an extreme case of sour grapes. If they had won, Blatter said ruefully, they would not have started this. In the Hallenstadion, the second-to-last candidate to speak, Gianni Infantino, had taken the podium. With a bald, bulging head and thick black brows, he began by showing off his linguistic dexterity, speaking first in English, then Italian, German, Swiss German, French, Spanish, and finally Portuguese. 5 months ago I was not thinking to be a candidate, Infantino said, returning to English. But many things have happened in the last few months. FIFA is in a crisis, he continued. I'm not afraid of taking my responsibilities and go ahead and do what is right for football and to do what is right for FIFA. Infantino had campaigned widely throughout Africa and Latin America, preaching transparency and reform. But the centerpiece of his platform was money. He pledged repeatedly to boost the funds distributed to each of FIFA's 209 member associations every 4 years to $5 million, more than 2.5 times above what was currently handed out. In addition, Infantino promised an additional $1 million to poorer national associations to cover travel costs, $40 million to each federation that could be dispensed for development projects within member countries, and $4 million for youth tournaments. Finally, he said, he would expand the World Cup to 40 teams from the current 32, which meant 8 more countries stood to receive huge cash influxes every 4 years. Sheikh Salman was critical of Infantino's plan, saying it would bankrupt FIFA. In the wake of the arrests, a string of sponsors, including Sony, Johnson & Johnson, and Emirates Air, had torn up their contracts with FIFA. Meanwhile, its legal costs exploded. The Swiss nonprofit would soon announce a $122 million loss for 2015, a year in which, it would later be revealed, it had paid Blatter $3.76 million. Salman, too, had made financial promises, but they were far more modest, and, he said, realistic. But the Bahraini was clearly missing the point. Infantino's platform was unvarnished, naked patronage. Regardless of which language he spoke in, he was simply offering to buy votes using the incredible cash-generating powers of the world's most popular sport to fund the expenditure, just as Blatter had done before him, and Avalanche before that. Lucre needed no translation. Despite all the scandal and promises of reform, soccer's governing body was still organized around financial opportunism. "The money of FIFA is your money," Infantino boomed, prompting a sustained round of applause and approving cheers from the audience. The actual voting was an agonizingly slow process, as each delegate approached the voting booths in turn, crossing the arena's large floor, and stopping to socialize and gladhand along the way. With no absolute majority conferred in the first round, the process was repeated. The full democratic exercise took nearly 4 hours, and to occupy part of that time, Blatter and his daughter stepped outside his home, climbed into the chauffeured Mercedes S-Class sedan that FIFA still provided him free of charge, and retired to the Sonnenberg for lunch. In the end, Infantino and his promise of great buckets of money cascading down from the mountains of Switzerland won out, 115 votes to 88. At 45, Infantino was a far younger man than his predecessor. He immediately pledged profound change and cast himself as a new kind of leader, memorably playing in an exhibition match, starring numerous retired soccer stars that he organized for the Monday after his election, in miserable, wet, snowy weather. But it was hard to overlook the remarkable similarities between him and Blatter. Both were multilingual Swiss who lived for their jobs, micromanaging every aspect of the organizations they oversaw. Both had served as general secretaries in their previous positions, and both had grown up in the remote mountainous region of Switzerland known as the Valais, in the small towns of Visp and, in Infantino's case, Brig, perched on the banks of the headwaters of the Rhone River, just 6 miles removed from each other. Before departing for lunch, Blatter glanced back at the screen on his tablet and watched the slow voting procession, then shook his balding head. "I cannot be the conscience of all these people," he said, pausing for a moment. "I am happy my presidency is over." The first time Steve Berryman met with Evan Norris and Amanda Hector back in September of 2011, he'd come prepared with a long list of names of soccer officials he believed were corrupt and should be brought to justice. Since then, the prosecutors had nabbed a few of them and indicted several others, but many more remained untouched. The fallout from the two indictments and all the publicity they had generated had been tremendous. People were popping up in the most unexpected places, offering to provide helpful information, such as former employees of Torneos y Competencias and Full Play, who had for years maintained secret lists of bribes to soccer officials and were all now eager to talk. Others, including the money-laundering son of a South American soccer official, whom two of Berryman's colleagues at the IRS confronted getting off an airplane in Los Angeles and immediately caught in a lie, needed a bit of encouragement. Those new cooperators helped tie up loose ends, making it increasingly clear that the theory of the case Norris had developed was true, and even more importantly, would stick in court. This was not going to turn out like the ill-fated Salt Lake City case. But tracking down every last possible witness in order to ensure convictions for every defendant in the trial, or busting Central American soccer officials who had taken a few bucks for a friendly match, wasn't what motivated Berryman and kept him at it day after day. It felt a bit like housekeeping. More than 4 years of ceaseless digging had added a considerable number of new names to Berryman's original wish list, and it was his desire to hunt them all down that drove him forward. They were the men who had debauched and cheapened the beautiful game for their own selfish ends. If the ultimate victims of all the corruption were the fans themselves, then Berryman, as a fan, also felt like a victim. For that reason, he had suggested early on that Norris include language in the criminal forfeiture agreements, making it clear that the money was intended for the victims of corruption rather than going to the U.S. Treasury, as usually happens. The idea was for soccer organizations, once they cleaned up their act, to request the money and reinvest it in the sport, underscoring the idea that it was the individuals, not the institutions, that were corrupt. Norris loved the idea, feeling it would help send the message that the case wasn't a huge money grab by Uncle Sam. Starting with Avila, every forfeiture agreement in the case noted that the funds would be subject to a restitution hold and that any individuals or entities that qualify as victims could apply for it. In March 2016, FIFA, now led by Infantino, did just that, formally requesting that the Justice Department hand over some of the more than $200 million the defendants in the case had so far consented to forfeit. It had also been Berryman who had pushed Norris when he filed his first MLAT to Switzerland to include a request to see the documents underlying the country's international sport and leisure investigation. Switzerland's initial response ran only 2 pages, thanks to Switzerland's restrictive privacy laws. But in late 2015, the lead prosecutor on the case, Thomas Hildebrand, agreed to let Berryman look over everything on the condition that he not take pictures or notes. So Berryman flew to Switzerland and sat in a police facility for a week, reading 72 boxes worth of documents before going home. It was incredible stuff, so beautifully thorough, and it inspired Berryman to keep going, showing him that many of his suspicions about FIFA's highest officials had been warranted. The work the investigators had done over the past 5 years was groundbreaking, but he was convinced that much more could still be done. With 2 indictments completed, Berryman redoubled his efforts. In early 2016, Berryman flew to Brooklyn to make another sales pitch. Facing a much larger group of prosecutors than he had in 2011, he delivered a 3-hour PowerPoint in a bid to convince Norris and the others to let him train his attentions on a new region of the world. The Asian Football Confederation has 47 member associations, stretching from Palestine and Jordan in the Middle East to Japan and South Korea in East Asia, as well as Australia. No AFC country has ever won the World Cup, but the quality of the region's play, and particularly the influence of its members on soccer's world stage, has been steadily progressing. What most interested Berryman about the Confederation was the fact that, until mid-2011, its president had been Mohammed bin Hammam, the billionaire Qatari whose cash-stuffed envelopes in Port of Spain had set everything in motion, and who had been accused many times of paying bribes to help his country win the right to host the 2022 World Cup. Bin Hammam was one of the names near the very top of Berryman's original list. Although the Qatari was referred to in both indictments as an unnamed co-conspirator, the prosecutors had never been convinced they had enough evidence to actually indict him. Asia was a tough nut to crack. With huge financial centers in Hong Kong, Shanghai, and Singapore, its banking system didn't depend as heavily on American correspondent banks for wire transfers as the West, which made it harder for Berryman to hunt for leads without leaving fingerprints. Still, he well knew, all it took was a well-placed cooperator, and everything could open right up. So while the rest of the team focused on milking their new South American cooperators for evidence, leaning on reticent defendants to take pleas, and reviewing old subpoenas to make sure no stones had been left unturned, Berryman busied himself researching dozens of AFC officials in search of a weak link. And when he finally found what he was looking for, he got the same charge of excitement he'd felt when he first peered into Chuck Blazer's file all those years earlier. Right around the time that FIFA elected Infantino as its new president, Berryman sent 2 of his colleagues across the Pacific Ocean to visit the offices of an obscure national association in a country hardly known for the quality of its soccer. The agents asked if they could see some innocuous documents, and left behind Berryman's business card. When the association president nervously reached out a few days later to see what it was all about, Berryman downplayed the significance. He had already traced the man's accounts and knew he had been taking bribes for years, including a highly suspicious $100,000 payment from Bin Hammam himself. But, just as he had with Zorana Danis, the IRS agent played dumb, suggesting they meet face to face. "It was nothing to worry about," Berryman assured the soccer official. "Just a boring tax case." Epilogue. The Trial. Soon after 7 on the evening of November 14, 2017, Jorge Delon, wearing a suit and carrying a leather briefcase, found a small gap in the barbed wire that fenced off the train tracks of the commuter line running through the Buenos Aires suburb of Lanús, and squeezed through. The 52-year-old lawyer stopped on the other side of the wall and waited. At 7:26 p.m., train 3251 of the Roca line struck Delon as it barreled south, killing him instantly. The engineer later said he saw the man dash onto the tracks and pulled the emergency brake, but far too late to stop the train. Police investigating the scene found various papers and legal documents inside Delon's briefcase, as well as a hastily scrawled note, apparently for his wife and four children.